Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. In news from the Vatican, Pope Benedict meets the president of Togo, and he addresses the students of Rome's oldest seminary, the Alma Copernica College. Black Pope elected. Father Adolfo Nicholas, a 71-year-old Spaniard, has been elected as the new Superior General of the Jesuits, a leader traditionally known as the Black Pope. In a letter to the outgoing leader, Pope Benedict says the Church needs the Jesuits' fidelity more than ever in today's society. Centenary Week. As the centenary of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity gets underway, we take a look at how this event is being marked by the Catholic Church in the US and Britain. Dangerous Church Building. Westminster Cathedral in London, the focal point for Catholics throughout England and Wales, is in urgent need of repair to prevent its domes from becoming a potential danger to the public. We find out more from the cathedral's administrator. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict received in audience President Nyasimbe of Togo on Saturday. The Togolese leader afterwards held talks with the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertoni, and the Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Dominique Mamberti. A communique released later by the Holy See's press office said the Togolese president paid tribute to the contribution made by Catholics towards the integral progress of his country's population. The communique stressed the need to bring about a full national reconciliation in Togo and also provide urgent aid to the many refugees and to the victims of flooding in Togo last October. In other news from the Vatican, the Pope today addressed students at Rome's oldest seminary, the Alma Copernica College. Charles Collins reports on that meeting.
Pope Benedict greeted the community of the Alma College Copernica on Saturday. This is the oldest Roman college, founded in 1417 by Cardinal Domenico Copernica for the training of priests.
Signor Cardinale, cari superiori alunni dell'Alma Collegio Copernica.
Pope Benedict remarked that Cardinal Copernica was interested in the spiritual formation of the future ministers of the altar and provided the constitutions that regulate the formation of the pupils. He says this spiritual dimension has supremacy in priestly formation.
Convinto dell'importanza che riveste la dimensione spirituale nella formazione dei futuri ministri dell'altare.
The Holy Father reminded the staff and students of the importance of cultivating a deep inner life with personal contact with Christ in prayer and a deep desire for sanctity. He said, without a true friendship with Christ, it's impossible for any Christian, let alone a priest, to complete the tasks the Lord entrusts to him. Pope Benedict said the location of the college is a providential gift, given the experiences that a student gains while studying in Rome. The presence of the Chair Peter and the contacts with other churches helps to enrich the Catholic spirit, understanding the universal dimension of the Church. He added that the presence of pupils from the Russian Orthodox Church imprints a further impulse to dialogue and gives hope to ecumenism. I'm Charles Collins.
Father Adolfo Nicholas, a 71-year-old Spaniard, has been elected as the new Superior General of the Jesuits, a leader traditionally known as the Black Pope. The new leader of the Society of Jesus Order succeeds Father Peter Hans Kolvenbach, who received permission from the Pope to step down for reasons of age. He turns 80 later this year. In a letter addressed to the outgoing Superior General, Pope Benedict urged the Jesuits to reaffirm their own total adhesion to Catholic doctrine. He said the Church has even more need today of this fidelity, which constitutes the distinctive sign of their order. Emma McCarthy tells us more about the contents of that letter from the Pope.
In his letter, Pope Benedict recalls the particular bond that binds the Society of Jesus to the successor of Peter, as expressed in the fourth vow of special obedience to the Pope. Quoting from John Paul II's message to the previous congregation, the 34th, the Holy Father continued that in order for evangelization to be successful, it is indispensable that the life of the members of the Society of Jesus, as also their doctrinal research, is constantly animated by a true spirit of faith and communion in humble fidelity to the teachings of the Magisterium. Pope Benedict XVI's letter goes on to discuss the Society's formative responsibility in the areas of theology, spirituality, and mission. In order to offer the entire Society of Jesus a clear orientation, writes the Pope, to support your generous and faithful apostolic dedication, it could prove extremely useful that the general congregation reaffirm in the spirit of St. Ignatius its own total adhesion to Catholic doctrine, in particular on those neuralgic points which today are strongly attacked by secular culture, as, for example, the relationship between Christ and religions, some aspects of the theology of liberation, and various points of sexual morality, especially as regards the indissolubility of marriage and the pastoral care of homosexual persons. Concluding, Pope Benedict writes, I am convinced that the Society senses the historic importance of this 35th General Congregation. Quoting from Paul VI, the letter concludes, all of us must be vigilant so that the necessary adaptation will not be accomplished to the detriment of the fundamental identity or essential character of the role of the Jesuit as the history and particular spirituality of the order propose it, and as the authentic interpretation of the very needs of the times seem still to require it. This image must not be altered. It must not be distorted. I am Ira McCarthy.
Pope Benedict this week urged the Church to pray without ceasing for Christian unity, so that all believers may profess Christ as their Saviour. The Pope's appeal was based on the theme for the 2008 Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which this year is marking its centenary. Pray without ceasing, taken from St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, is in fact the theme chosen for this centenary year. This yearly observance began back in 1908. It was known then as the Church Unity Octave, and was initiated by the American Episcopalian clergyman, the Reverend Paul Watson, who converted to Catholicism a year later. From this small beginning 100 years ago, the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has grown in scope and is now observed throughout the Christian community worldwide. Since 1966, it has been a joint project of the Catholic Church and the World Council of Churches. Each year, the Week of Prayer begins on January the 18th, which is the Feast of St. Peter's Chair, and ends on January the 25th, which is the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul. Atonement Father James Gardner is director of the Graymore Spiritual Life Center in New York State, that contains the chapel where the very first observance of the Christian Unity Octave was held in 1908. He told me more about the origins and history of this yearly event and how it has evolved over the past 100 years. I began by asking him how this year's centenary is being marked.
Well, Graymore is the mother house and world headquarters of the Franciscan Friars and Sisters of the Atonement. It does contain the chapel, Our Lady of the Angels Chapel, where the Church Unity Octave was first observed in 1908. And so we will be using that chapel for a couple of events. Last Sunday, we had a small gathering to preview the Week of Prayer for our neighbors, who were really amazed and really excited about the fact that something that has started here locally, inauspiciously, has now spread throughout the world and has the endorsement and wholehearted support of both the Vatican and the World Council of Churches. But Graymore isn't the only place where there will be observances. There'll be observances in New York City that we found out about, observances in Washington, D.C., San Antonio, Texas. Most of the observances are prayer services, ecumenical prayer services involving Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, and evangelical clergy participating in them, clergy and congregations. But there are some other things that are going on as well. exchanges among churches where people can see where and how one another worships. So there's a lot of things going on. We've also had, by the way, a very successful hymn competition. We had 153 new hymns were submitted. Two were selected based on the theme, That All May Be One, St. John's Gospel. And we also had an illustration competition where artists, over 50 artists, submitted their ideas of how to illustrate the theme this year called Pray Without Ceasing. That's from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. So a lot of things have already gone on in anticipation of the week of prayer. A lot of things are going on right now across this country and around the world. And we're really heartened that something that started here so inauspiciously 100 years ago, but with the devotion and the vision of the founders of Graymoor, we're really heartened that this has picked up and is spread now throughout the world.
Well, as you say, it's moved on a long way in the last 100 years. But going back for a while to its origins, as you said, it began in quite a small way there at Graymoor. And the founders, in fact, were Episcopalian, and then they converted to Catholicism, didn't they? But the actual Church Unity Octave, as it was known then, was more limited in scope than the present observance, wasn't it? Because it was a movement that explicitly prayed for the return of non-Catholic Christians to Rome.
Exactly. It was influenced by what was called, or what is called, return theology, which since the Vatican II, the Vatican Second Vatican Council, I mean, the Christian churches and the Catholic Church has moved past that, in retrospect, narrow concept of Christian unity. The original Church Unity Octave became the chair of Unity Octave to reinforce this whole idea of Christian unity as return to Rome. And then Abbé Couturier in Lyon in the 30s, he had started what he called a universal week of prayer for Christian unity. And it took the Second Vatican Council to as one of the results of the decree on ecumenism, was that both movements, what had become the chair of Unity Octave and this universal week of prayer for Christian unity, they were merged into the one observance, January 18th to the 25th, and that was one of the results of the Second Vatican Council. So we've moved on. We've moved on past even not from only from return theology, but also we've moved on to see what some people have described as the wider ecumenism, being the encounter of the Christian churches with other religions, not just other churches, but other religions. In other words, people are challenged to go beyond the traditional established borders, and as one preacher pointed out recently, to see what God is doing behind these artificial barriers that we have put up.
Well, coming back to that theme of the artificial barriers and here this week of prayer for Christian unity, when it comes to ecumenism in general in the USA, how would you define its current state of health?
I'd say it's the current state of health and the ecumenical movement, it's good. I don't think it's visible enough, though. There's an awful lot that's going on every level, so much so that, for instance, a lot of things that people are doing, they just take for granted now, and they don't think of them as being specifically ecumenical, whether it's on a social level, meeting the needs of people in shelters and soup kitchens and that type of thing, to dialogues that are taking place, official, national, regional, local, neighborhood dialogues that are taking place, Bible study that's being done together. I just think that ecumenism has become so much a part of our experience over the last 40 years that we've stopped thinking about ecumenism as being something special. It's part of the way we live our lives and practice our faith. That's not to say, though, that there couldn't be more explicit forms of ecumenism that we can rest that it's already accomplished.
The problem sometimes mentioned about ecumenism, though, is that although Christians all agree in principle with the concept of being united, being one with Christ, in practice it's very difficult to make concrete progress towards breaking down those theological obstacles. And when progress does occur in this field, it's very, very slow. Does this tend to discourage people?
I think it tends to discourage impatient people. I mean, I think of a quote that I saw that Father Paul Watson, our founder, wrote many years ago. He died in 1940, so it was well before that he wrote this. And the quote is, "Patience must be allowed plenty of time to do her work perfectly." It's something I think that we can all think of as, it's almost like a mantra to think about this, that we have to be patient, because Christian unity is ultimately the work of the Spirit.
That was Father James Gardner, director of the Graymore Spiritual Life Center in New York State.
Come Holy Spirit, we need you. Our brokenness, heal and make whole. Come Holy Spirit, we need.
In Britain, Catholic Church leaders are also marking the centenary of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, with a series of special services up and down the country. The head of the Bishops' Conference's Committee for Christian Unity is Bishop Michael Evans of East Anglia. He told me more about how this centenary of the Week of Prayer is being marked in Britain.
Most of the things, of course, go on at local level in parishes, where probably they're most effective. But most cathedrals would have special events. And certainly in Westminster Abbey, the four presidents of churches together in England, including the Cardinal, are leading a very special celebration to mark the centenary.
The Week of Prayer began, though, in quite a small way 100 years ago. It resulted from an initiative between two Episcopalian clergymen. But it's grown enormously since then, hasn't it? I mean, how much bigger have you seen it becoming, even in your lifetime?
It's grown a lot in our lifetime. I think we need to remember it started even before 1908, even Pope Leo XIII, way back in 1895, tried to get going a Week of Prayer for Christian unity, I think between Ascension and Pentecost. So it's got very deep roots in the Christian tradition. And of course, Father Paul Couturier took it up in 1933, and World Council of Churches developed it. And 1966 onwards, Second Vatican Council, it really becomes something very important. And it's in the last 42 years, I suppose, that it's really taken off. At first with great enthusiasm, and I think because we're grinding now with church unity in a way, we're still moving forward, but the enthusiastic phase is not quite the same. It's a much more down-to-earth kind of approach.
Now, you talked about perhaps a waning somewhat of enthusiasm. Is that because people have become aware of the obstacles that stand in the way, particularly there in England, between the Anglican Communion and the Catholic Church, you know, and also the new difficulties that have arisen in that ecumenical dialogue, for instance, the ordination of women?
I think perhaps waning enthusiasm wasn't quite the right word. It's more that whenever you begin something, especially after 400 years of division, there was a great passion and a real thought that perhaps Christian unity was around the corner. We now know it's a very long path. It's that we need to keep on taking important steps, but it's a long way ahead. Full, visible, sacramental unity is a long way off. And therefore, that initial passion perhaps has waned. But there are still many, many people in parishes and in dioceses who are totally committed to Christian unity, and we need to keep that going. And I think Christian Unity Week is a way of spurring us on for the other 51 weeks of the year so that we really do keep going.
And can you give us some examples of the concrete ways in terms of initiatives and projects that you do perhaps in your diocese with the other Christian denominations?
Yes, certainly in East Anglia, we are blessed with very good relationships between church leaders, very friendly relationships. In fact, we see ourselves as friends, I think. And that makes a big difference when people see church leaders enjoying being with each other, enjoying each other's company. It really does witness to the unity we already share, as well as that desire that we grow into full unity. In Norwich, the two cathedrals there, the Anglican and Roman Catholic Cathedral, work very closely together, for example. We have annual services together. The two bishops meet regularly. And there's a joint pilgrimage between people from the Roman Catholic Cathedral and people from the Anglican Cathedral to Rome and to Italy and various other places in the world as well. And there's a general working together during the rest of the year.
To sum up, how do you feel about the future of ecumenism?
I think we know there are difficulties, and some of the things you mentioned just now are a good example of that. But Christian unity is so important that it's something we must not give up on. I think as the Holy Father put it the other day, it's not an option, it's a sacred duty. It's the Lord's mandate that we work for Christian unity.
That was Bishop Michael Evans of East Anglia.
I am the way.
Staying in Britain, it was announced this week that London's Westminster Cathedral, the mother church and focal point for the Catholic community throughout England and Wales, is in urgent need of repair to prevent its domes from becoming a potential danger to the public. At a press conference, Cardinal Murphy O'Connor launched a £3 million appeal for the cathedral to fund a major programme of restoration works and urgent repairs. Westminster Cathedral was built at the end of the 19th century and, with its distinctive Byzantine architecture, is one of London's most striking landmarks. The cathedral boasts the largest nave in Britain, and its interior, although still incomplete, contains fine marble works and mosaics. It also has a famous choir that is widely considered to be one of the finest in the world, and whose music you heard at the start of this report. Well, to tell me more about Westminster Cathedral, its history, and provide more details about those urgently needed repairs, I spoke to the cathedral's administrator, Monsignor Mark Langham. I began by asking him whether there is a risk of collapse.
No, because we're catching the work in time, and it's prudent that we begin work now. So I have to make it very clear, we're not in danger of bricks falling on people's heads at the moment. We wouldn't allow that to happen. But if we don't act now, then within the next 5 to 10 years, we will be in that situation. And that's what our investigations have shown.
When and how did you discover this problem? Was it just during a routine survey?
That's correct. We've never been able to look closely at the vaults of the cathedral because they're so high, and we'd only observe them from ground level. We didn't have the technology to get close to them, but early in 2007, finally, we did manage to get hold of a lifting material, a crane from Italy, in fact, that enabled us to go the 104 feet, the 34 meters up to the domes and look inside them. And what we saw there concerned us greatly. We realized that unless we acted immediately, then within a few years we would be facing a serious situation.
How long and how easy do you believe it will take to raise this large sum of money you are requesting?
We're hoping in the first place to raise £1 million within this year. That's for the most urgent work. And then work related to it, a further £3 million for wiring and the various other alterations we have to make to the cathedral, is staged over a longer period of 2 or 3 years. But we do need to do the urgent work this year, so we're hoping to raise that £1 million within 2008.
How disruptive will these works be? Because, of course, this is a very busy cathedral, isn't it? I gather it has seven masses celebrated every day.
Seven masses every day, 7 hours of confessions every day. So we want to keep the cathedral as functioning as possible. So we've constructed the scaffolding so that people will still be able to see the sanctuary and processions will still be able to take place. But inevitably, there'll be a big presence of scaffolding in the nave and people will notice it, I'm afraid, but we can't avoid it if we're to do this essential work.
And how have people reacted to the news?
I think people are a little bit concerned about how disruptive it will be, most especially people getting married next year. I've had lots of phone calls from worried brides and grooms. But on the whole, I think people are very understanding and they're glad that we're doing this work now because it means we can hand the cathedral on to the next generation in good shape. And that matters a lot to people.
Well, let's look a little bit at the cathedral itself. It was built at the end of the 19th century and it's got this very distinct Byzantine style of architecture, doesn't it? I mean, how did that come about? Why did the architect decide to go for this very distinctive style?
It was an ingenious suggestion made to Cardinal Vaughan by John Francis Bentley. Firstly, he didn't want to build in the prevailing Gothic style because just up the road, a kilometre or two away, is Westminster Abbey, which is such a superb example of medieval Gothic that we would be bound to suffer by comparison. Secondly, the Byzantine style does relate to a wider aspect of the church and so is not so rooted specifically to this culture, but proclaims that the Roman Catholic faith is a universal faith. But then there were some very practical reasons as well. You can build a Byzantine Florentine Cathedral relatively quickly and then decorate it over the subsequent centuries. So the building was built in just 8 years and opened for worship, which was tremendous. And then finally, being based on a dome, it gives an ample space inside for 2,000 people to have an uninterrupted view of the liturgy, of the sacred liturgy, without pillars, columns, aisles being in the way. So for many reasons, it was an extraordinary and very fortuitous choice.
And is it true that it has the largest nave of a church in Britain?
The widest and the tallest nave of any church or cathedral in Britain, yes. Again, because we're not based on the arch of Gothic architecture, which only allows you a certain breadth of span. The dome of a Byzantine cathedral really enables you to have a very large and uncluttered space where people can celebrate and join in the liturgy.
I gather it's also famed for its fine marble work and that there are more than 100 different types used?
Absolutely. The builders of the cathedral opened up a lot of the ancient quarries. They, in fact, went back to some of the quarries that were used for Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, now Istanbul, and many ancient quarries to bring in that authentic Byzantine aspect. But we also looked around imaginatively for the St. Patrick's Chapel. We've used Irish marble. We've used Scottish marble for the St. Andrew's Chapel. There's even some Greek Pentelic marble in the Chapel of St. Paul, recalling his links with Greece and preaching in Athens. So it's a real treasure trove of marble.
And finally, Westminster Cathedral, of course, has this choir, which is one of the most famous in the world. Tell us something about that.
When Cardinal Vaughan founded our cathedral in 1903, he wanted it to celebrate the liturgy to the highest possible standard, and so founded a cathedral school along the lines of Anglican cathedral schools. And ever since, that choir has really achieved the highest levels of church music. Under its very inspirational first director, Sir Richard Terry, they rediscovered a great wealth of polyphony that the church as a whole had really forgotten from the 16th and 17th century. And the choir here became really the first choir to rediscover and promote that sort of music. And ever since, it's really been a benchmark for singing the church's repertoire of historical music, as well as commissioning new pieces and singing every day, the only cathedral in the world where Mass is sung and solemn Mass is sung by the choir every single day. And we are very proud of that fact, remaining true to the vision of Cardinal Vaughan and recalling the great musical choral tradition of this country for so many centuries.
That was Monsignor Mark Langham, administrator for Westminster Cathedral. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.